The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
I'm Valerie Irwin, and I own a restaurant in Mount Airy called Geechee Girl Rice Cafe. And in a shameless bit of self-promotion, I'll say that Jessica is collaborating with us on a meal tomorrow night. And if you're interested, you can find out more after the talk. I'd read a little article in the New York Times about one of her early books, Iron Pots and Wooden Spoons. It wasn't a review. It was just like a one-paragraph overview. And it talked about how the book was about the food of the African diaspora. I went out the next day and bought the book. And I don't even remember looking at it before I paid for it because I was so sure that this book was going to make a connection for me, and I was really right. Over the years, I've had an opportunity to read a lot of Jessica's books. They all have a similar theme of the food of African peoples on the continent and in the New World, although the specific subjects might change. And each book is part travelogue, part personal history, and part, of course, cookbook. I've never been to Africa, but after reading Jessica's books, I feel like I have been. And I feel like I've shopped in her markets, I've met her friends, I've cooked in her kitchen. With this latest book, High on the Hog, she manages to marry her scholarly background and her love of food, and to use food as a way to examine history. And with this book, she lets us travel not just in space, but in time. In one of her books, in one of her early books, she talks about how in New Orleans, everybody knows you eat red beans and rice on Mondays because Mondays is wash day. But as she points out, not a lot of people remember who did the cooking and who did the washing. So in this book, in High on the Hog, she lets us remember not only who did the cooking and who did the washing, but the people they came from and the people they became. And would you join me now in welcoming Jessica Harris?
Well, good evening, and thank you, and quadruple thank you for coming out in this weather. You all deserve gold stars and the blue plate special.
Oh, can we have the blue plate special?
If I only knew what it was. I'm going to sort of begin just by informally kind of presenting myself and just talking a little bit about myself and then go on to read you some passages. I had thought about this as I was sort of confecting. You know, one of the things that happens when you're asked to speak is they ask you 3 or 4 months in advance of whatever it is you're going to do. You have a brilliant idea then, and by the time you actually come to do it, it's like, that wasn't so smart. Why did I try to do that? So anyhow, in the reconfecting and the rejigging of things, I decided that I wanted to do something in the guise of presenting the history of African-American food in 10 faces, if you will. But before I do that, I'd like to talk about me in Philadelphia, because it's a city that's long been a part of my life. As a child growing up, I was told that my uncle, Ed Philpott, was the first African-American to run for mayor of Philadelphia. Now, I suspect that may be apocryphal, but I have talked to a couple of people who said that may not be exactly as apocryphal as I think. But he lost, needless to say. But it made me feel a link with this city. The link was more firmly established in the fall of 1964 when I came down in my parents' car that was loaded to its 1960 shark fins with my books, clothes, and assorted impedimenta to attend my freshman year at Bryn Mawr. And I quickly learned how to take the Paoli local into town. And I can still tell you that old maids never wed and have babies rarely. Overbrook, Marion, Narberth, Wynwood, Ardmore, Haverford, Bryn Mawr, and Radnor. Now, if that doesn't give me Philly cred, I don't know what does. Okay? I attended Bryn Mawr in the days when Philadelphia was a very staid city. Folks got dressed up, and I mean dressed, hat, fur, gloves, to go to Strawbridge and Clothier. And my first credit card, which my parents probably rued the day of giving me, was one that they gave me for that establishment so that I could get anything that I needed at the last minute for school. It did begin a lifelong love of shopping. Then Philadelphia was not the food city that it has become and the fine dining mecca. Fine dining on parents' weekends in those days was, if we ventured beyond the establishments on the main line, the original bookbinders with Pepper Pot, which was a must. And little did I know then that Philadelphia's Pepper Pot would become a link in the chain of food research that I would pursue. After graduation, I spent many years away from the city until one day I got a call to participate in what became an annual ritual called The Book and the Cook. I attended with my beloved mother every year for the first 10 years, going from Philadelphia restaurant to Philadelphia restaurant. I never quite found a spot that I just stayed. That's because I didn't know Valerie Irvin at that point. But it was fun to work with Judy Fay and her team and to watch firsthand as the city's culinary culture grew and expanded. I journeyed again to Philadelphia a few years ago to receive the Tok Award and to become the first African-American, and I think certainly the first African-American woman to do so. It was a special day and coincided with my birthday, and it was a day filled with honor, memory, because by that time my mother had died, and cake. My last trip to Philadelphia was a few years ago, well, actually last year, to honor my friend Chef Fritz Blank, whose establishment, De Cheminée, had become my Philadelphia home. And now I'm back in one of my favorite American cities, and I want to thank the organizers of these talks at the Free Library, especially Andy Kahan. I hope I'm not mispronouncing it too badly. Okay. For the invitation, and of course, Valerie Irvin for the introduction. Today I'm supposed to speak of the history of African Americans in food, which is the subject of my latest book, High on the Hog, A Culinary Journey from Africa to America. I will do so, but since I'm in Philadelphia, I also want to speak about the extraordinary African-American culinary legacy of this city. Because in this city occupies a place of primacy unequaled by the city of my birth, New York, and perhaps second only to that of my adopted city, New Orleans. Okay? Well, yeah, sort of. But, I mean, the thing that's great about Philly is that it has this extraordinary background that we'll get into. But let's begin by what I like to think of as those 10 faces. Some of the faces have names. Others are nameless ghosts of the untold millions of folks who toiled, died, and were forgotten by all but their kin, who are recalled to life by the pouring of libation and the soothing salve of words. Let's talk first about Olauda Equiano, who actually has a Philadelphia connection. Equiano is a man who wrote one of the earliest accounts that we have of enslavement, and more specifically, one of the only accounts that we have of the Middle Passage. Hanging on the walls of the Royal Albert Memorial Museum in Exeter, England, is an 18th century portrait of a black man. The man is dressed in the clothing of the period, a scarlet waistcoat and immaculate white stock, simply tied. He gazes at the observer from the canvas with a slight smile at the corners of his full mouth. The smile, though, does not reach his eyes, which are filled with sadness. The portrait, attributed to a member of the English school, is titled Portrait of a Negro Man, Olauda Equiano. Olauda Equiano, also known as Gustavus Vassa, was the individual who offered the first and most detailed account of his capture, enslavement, and journey to America in the Middle Passage. While many slave narratives detail the lives of the enslaved in the 19th century, few portrayed 18th century life. And even fewer still detail the horrors of capture and the degradation of the Middle Passage. Much of what the world knows about this early period of the slave trade comes from Equiano's autobiography. Born an Igbo in what would become Nigeria, Equiano led an extraordinary life. Captured as a child, he was sold to various African masters and eventually found himself in the hands of white slave traders who shipped him to the colonies, where he was taken to Barbados, and from Barbados, eventually sold in Virginia to Michael Pascal. His master was a naval captain, and as Pascal's personal servant, Equiano accompanied him, traveled to Europe. With his master, he saw action in the Seven Years' War and was given rudimentary naval training. He also performed a variety of military duties aboard ship. During the journeys with his master, which took him far afield as the Mediterranean and Canada, he received an education and learned to read and write. At the end of the war, however, Equiano did not reap the benefits that had been promised, prize money and freedom. Instead, he was sold again, this time in the Caribbean, where travels had taken him. His education made him too valuable for plantation labor, but potential buyers were leery of acquiring a slave who could read and write and who knew how to navigate a ship. You could understand that. He was eventually sold to Robert King, a Quaker merchant from Philadelphia, who allowed Equiano to engage in his own trading activities and promised he would free him upon payment of £40. By the time he'd reached his 20s, Equiano had earned enough through his trading to pay the debt and was a free man. But as unscrupulous traders had attempted to re-enslave him during his Philadelphia sojourn, Equiano fully understood the perils of being a free black in federal America and declined King's offer to remain there and become his business partner. Rather, he journeyed to England, where he spent the rest of his life, and wrote an extraordinary autobiography that made him a public figure. It was published in 1789, 3 months before the storming of the Bastille. It was a runaway bestseller in London and directly influenced British attitudes towards slavery and fueled the abolitionist cause. But in the book, he remembered not only the travails of the Middle Passage, the brutalities of enslavement, and the multiple events of his peripatetic life. He also remembered the tastes of Africa and recalled the foods eaten in his African village. And I quote from Equiano, "Our manner of living is entirely plain, for as yet the natives are unacquainted with those refinements of cookers which debauch the taste. Bullocks, goats, and poultry supply the greatest part of their food. These constitute likewise the principal wealth of the country and the chief articles of its commerce. The flesh is usually stewed in a pan. To make it savory, we sometimes also use pepper and other spices, and we have salt made from wood ashes. Our vegetables are mostly plantains, edas, which would probably edos, another form of tuber, yams, true yam, not sweet potatoes, beans, and Indian corn. They are totally unacquainted with strong or spirituous liquors, and their principal beverage is palm wine. This is gotten from the tree of that name by tapping it at the top and fastening a large gourd to it. And sometimes one tree will yield 3 or 4 gallons in a night. When just drawn, it is of a most delicious sweetness, but in a few days, it requires a tartish and more spirituous flavor." Several scholars today question whether or not Equiano was, as he advertised himself, an Igbo from Esaka. It has been argued that his autobiography is a composite one made up of the reminiscences of a lot of enslaved, or even that it was the work of pure imagination. But no matter the final verdict, the interesting narrative of the life of Olauda Equiano remains a moving account of the trade that ripped millions from their homeland and transported them to another hemisphere for more than 5 centuries. Equiano, our first face, speaks for the millions of deported captives and arrived enslaved with no families, no friends, and no possessions. Nothing except the fading memories of their distant homeland and perhaps, like Equiano, the fleeting memory of the sweetness of palm wine on their tongues. Our second face, another story of approach, promise, and betrayal. a year later, when we're going back in time at this point, we're talking about Esteban Cico. The Spanish arrived more permanently on the North American mainland on an Easter Sunday in 1527 and named the place they landed Pascua Florida, Flowery Easter, in honor of the day. They set out in search of gold and riches, which they hoped would rival those found in Central and South America. With them was the first African known by name to step foot ashore in what would become the United States on the North American continent, Esteban Dorantes. He was a slave of Andres Dorantes. Esteban Cico, little Esteban, or Esteban Nico, as he is sometimes called, was from Azemur in Morocco and had been a slave in Spain. He followed his master to the New World as part of the 1527 expedition of Panfilo de Nayavez, who landed near Tampa, Florida. Now, this man was, Panfilo de Nayavez, a very bad leader. He landed on the coast near Tampa with 400 men, bent on conquest. He was, you know, a conquistador. He had such an accumulation of bad decisions. First bad decision, separate his men from the provisioning ships. Tactical errors were compounded by encounters with hostile Indians. Nature terrorized the expedition in the form of alligators, mosquitoes, and snakes. Then there was a hurricane. The ships were destroyed, and the survivors were reduced to using what timber they could salvage to build a raft and sail along the Gulf of Mexico in hopes of finally reaching Mexico. They landed near Galveston, Texas. And there, under the leadership of Alvar Núñez Cabeza de Vaca, set out to walk to Mexico. Astonishingly, 8 years later, four of them actually arrived in Mexico and amazed the viceroy with their tales of the southwestern portion of the country. Esteban Dorantes was one of the four. After initially being enslaved by some of the Indians, Cabeza de Vaca's group began to move through the country. The four lived on nuts, rabbits, spiders, and the juice of prickly pears and learned to forage in the new land. Times of famine alternated with times of plenty, depending on the terrain and the welcome of the various native peoples that they encountered. During the 8-year odyssey with the Cabeza de Vaca band, Esteban Cico found that he became accustomed to the ways of the Indians and was regarded by them with wonder. A remarkable linguist, and I think that that was something else that was proven over and over and over again in my research, was that there were incredible abilities, and the linguistic ability was one, a certain kind of cultural fluidity, and Esteban Cico certainly evidenced it. He rapidly acquired many of the Indian languages and proved to be a leader of the group and a healer. More importantly, he was a man who had that cultural fluidity. It seemed he was able to understand the ways of native peoples and adjust to them with more alacrity than his Spanish fellow travelers. As the years progressed, he came to be regarded as a shaman by the native peoples. In his narrative, La Relación, first published in 1542 as a report to the Spanish king, Cabeza de Vaca speaks of Esteban as being, and I quote, I don't quote in Spanish, I'm going to quote in English, constantly in conversation and finding out about routes, towns, and other matters we wished to know, end quote. When the group finally arrived after that 8-year sojourn in Mexico City and was taken to the astonished Governor Antonio de Mendoza, the first Spanish viceroy of Mexico, he listened to their tale with amazement. The Europeans were rewarded with riches and became heroes. Esteban, however, despite his aid to the expedition, was not freed. Instead, he was purchased by the viceroy and given to a friar, Marcos de Niza, who led a second expedition back into the little-known territory. The new group embarked with Esteban in the lead as translator and expediter, but the voyage was not successful. Although the welcome was warm at times, many of the Indians had become wary of Europeans, and animosities among tribes created contention. Esteban, caught in the tribal conflicts, was killed by the Indians in Hawikut, a settlement just over 10 miles southwest of the Zuñi Pueblo. Esteban's remarkable journey among America's first peoples encapsulates the relationship between black man and red man in early America. It is a saga of admiration and friendship turning to mistrust and hostility that would be repeated over and over again in the country's early years. Esteban Cico. Now we're going to come into Philadelphia. And this morning, and I got here early, I don't know if any of you heard, I did an interview on WHYY's, one of their shows this morning. And afterwards, I walked back to my hotel, and I'm staying at the Omnion, I think it's Chestnut, Fourth Street. But in any case, walking back, I stopped at the president's house. And I stopped at the president's house to pay homage to the next one of our faces. Like many cities in the fledgling nation, Philadelphia had an African underpinning that came from the bustling port, where ships arrived daily from the Caribbean and from Africa, bringing foods, goods, and slaves, and giving the city a lively Creole feel. The docks and seaport areas of Philadelphia and other northern maritime cities were riddled with warehouses that were Alibaba's caves of ingredients. Fresh off the boat, plantains, mangoes, while not common, were known among the well-to-do, as were pineapples, a delicacy of the Caribbean origin. Actually, pineapples originate in the Caribbean. They are from Antigua, believe it or not. I always connect them sort of mentally with Hawaii. But the pineapples became the symbol of hospitality because some of the ship captains, when they returned from the Caribbean, would take a pineapple and spike it on the gates to their houses, and that would be their signal that they were home, but it was also a signal, became a signal of welcome. Some of the more exotic ingredients would have been familiar to saltwater Negroes, saltwater slaves. Saltwater, those who came directly from the African continent. Caribbean blacks also knew their uses and no doubt demonstrated them to their mistresses. Women wandered the streets with trays selling their own version of a West African okra-based gumbo, complete with fufu dumplings, fufu pounded plantain, or another vegetable starch, that would become known as that thing that I had for lunch today at City Tavern, Philadelphia's pepper pot, which is really, used to be sold, actually called Philadelphia gumbo. The spicy dish prepared from inexpensive cuts of meat and vegetables was sold for pennies by the hucksters of West Indian origin. Although pepper pot certainly had West Indian origins, the good, hearty soup of meat and greens also had African-American antecedents. In 1778, one soldier from the Revolutionary War recalled that a free black woman, and here's the quote, having received $2 for washing and hearing of the distress of our prisoners in the jail, went to market and brought some neck beef and 2 heads with some greens and made a pot of as good a broth as she could. Again, between those two antecedents, it became a Philadelphia classic. And the street vendor's cry, pepper it pot, smoking hot, is even illustrated in an 1810 pamphlet of street cries of Philadelphia. The city would be a proving ground for African Americans in food for more than 3 years. I'm going to talk only about one of the chefs because I see time is moving. But two black chefs would come to prominence in Creolized 18th century Philadelphia. They worked in a city where Caribbean and colonial combined and where a group of free blacks created a black cultural institutions such as churches, abolitionist organizations, and more early on. Each was from Virginia, and although they had very different paths, they both became culinary stars of the era and attained levels of the culinary profession that remained and remain unequaled to this day. Each worked for one of America's founding fathers. In the 21st century, it is difficult to conceive that at the time of the First Continental Congress, all the 13 original colonies were slaveholding. And I'll say that again because it gobsmacked me. All of the original 13 colonies were slaveholding. Indeed, no signer of the Declaration of Independence was without the taint of slavery. Even if the individual was not a slaveholder himself, all the districts represented by the signers were slaveholding. It was the norm, therefore, that the father of the country was a slaveholder, not an exception. George Washington's plantation, Mount Vernon, comprised 8,000 acres and was divided into five separate farms on which the enslaved worked. At Mount Vernon, and later in New York and in Philadelphia, Washington's kitchen was manned by enslaved blacks, overseen by a slave big house cook. At Mount Vernon, this person was named Hercules. I always sort of think of Eddie Murphy as the clumps going, Hercules, Hercules. But this Hercules was described as a celebrated artiste and an accomplished master of the culinary arts by his contemporaries. He had begun his life in the kitchen in Mount Vernon, probably as a member of some house servant's family. Little is known about him, although increasingly more and more is known. Like many of the young boys who worked around the big houses in the South, he was no doubt first tasked with hauling water and bringing logs, removing ashes and other menial jobs, and then he worked his way up the pecking order. It is known that he was named chief cook at Mount Vernon by 1786. Hercules was brought to New York when his master George Washington was displeased with the presidential fare there, and in 1790, when the capital moved to Philadelphia, Hercules moved there. Here with Washington. He won accolades and was noted for his exacting efficiency and the flawless working of his kitchen at 190 High Street. Martha Washington's grandson, George Washington Parke Custis, called him, and I quote, as highly accomplished and as proficient in the culinary art as could be found in the United States. High praise indeed. Another observer was more eloquent, and I quote again, iron discipline. Woe to his underlings if speck or spot could be discovered on the table, or if the utensils did not shine like polished silver. His underlings flew in all directions to execute his orders, while he, the great master spirit, seemed to possess the power of ubiquity and to be everywhere at the same time. Hercules' duties extended beyond simply cooking. He also oversaw the smooth running of Washington's kitchen, which at one point contained a German cook and two French ones. He managed their work. No recipes attributed to Hercules have been found, but he must certainly have been adept at preparing the steak and kidney pie and the trifle that were known to be among Washington's favorite dishes. He was charged not only with overseeing the family meals, from preparation to the service, but also with preparing the more formal Thursday dinners and congressional repasts. Although I learned today, having had lunch at City Tavern, that if there were over 25 people at table, those meals would have been served at City Tavern. But they were served at either place, atop white linen and accompanied by glittering crystal fine porcelain and highly polished silver. Now, Hercules was fascinating because he oversaw it all, he was respected by his peers, and feared by his underlings, who dreaded his exactitude and iron discipline, and renowned in Philadelphia as the president's chef. He was also a dandy, and it's those little personal vignettes that make it fun sometimes to research. Although enslaved, he, like many free chefs of the period, was able to sell leftover food and tallow, bacon drippings, fat. And the fat was useful in the making of candles, which was illumination at that point. His perquisites from the kitchen garnered him the tidy sum of almost $200 a year. No mean feat. Following the service of presidential meals, he would step out onto the streets of Philadelphia, get this mental picture now, immaculately attired, linen, silk shorts, waistcoat, velvet-collared frock coat, silver-buckled shoes, and a cocked hat while brandishing a gold-headed cane. And he would head forth to meet other fashionable black dandies of the time. The city was full of black notables. Hercules was one of them, and he was certainly aware of the others. However, despite his princely income, his fame, and his relative freedom of movement, Hercules was not content with his lot. He wanted his freedom. He yearned for it and planned for it and escaped when he could. Tobias Lear, Washington's longtime personal secretary, recorded his escape. Quote, "It is sad to relate that Uncle Harkless, H-A-R-K-L-E-S-S, a pronunciation corruption of Hercules, was so captivated with the delights of Philadelphia that in 1797, on the day Washington left the city to retire to private life at the end of his second term, he ran away." Now, there's contention about this. In fact, today at the President's House, I read that he ran away from Mount Vernon. I will have to research further, but this is the quote from Tobias Lear. He ran away rather than return to Mount Vernon. Although diligent inquiries were made for him, he was never apprehended. So Hercules ran off. His escape troubled the Washington family. "The running off of my cook has been a most inconvenient thing to this family," wrote Washington, who spared no expense in attempting to find him, no doubt finding it difficult to understand why one so favored would leave. Washington charged Frederick Kitt, his former household steward in Philadelphia, with finding Hercules and returning his property to him, noting, and I quote again, "But little doubt remains in my mind of his having gone to Philadelphia, and he may yet be found there if proper measures were employed to discover, unsuspectedly so as not to alarm him, where his haunts are." It was to no avail. He had slipped off into the night. His six-year-old daughter, who remained enslaved at Mount Vernon, expressed the thoughts that were probably more representative of those of Uncle Harkless himself. When asked by a guest at Mount Vernon if she were upset to never see her father again, she replied, "Oh, sir, I am very glad, because he is free now." Despite our lack of knowledge of him or his dishes, Hercules, the chef who doesn't even have a last name for history, was more than a grace note to the history of African-American chefs. He was the first black chef for the country's first chief executive. And one more. The other chef was James Hemings, and we don't, unfortunately, have time to talk about James Hemings. I got all of these people marked, and we're not going to have time to talk about them. Andy, will you throw something when it gets a little too late? I think I'm heading on in that general direction. But more about Philadelphia, because this city really was an extraordinary linchpin. Philadelphia was a pivotal city for the growth of African Americans in food service. Blacks in culinary service had long been the norm here. Here it was, after all, a city that had seen culinary likes of George Washington's Hercules and Jefferson's James Hemings. Pre-Civil War, Philadelphia was a port city that depended on the money, shipping, and patronage of Southerners. Many from the Old South wintered in the city and enjoyed its cultural attractions. In the early years of the 19th century, Philadelphia was also a place that beckoned to African Americans. Its Quaker heritage made it a potential safe haven for those fleeing from the South. The city continued to maintain connections with the Caribbean, and following the Haitian Revolution of 1804, it received an increase of immigrants from that island, both white and black, free and enslaved, many of whom joined the blacks working in the food service industries. In 1810, it was estimated that there were 11,000 free blacks living in Philadelphia and at least another 4,000 fugitives seeking asylum in various ways. The city's black community grew by more than 30% in the decade between 1820 and 1830 alone. By the 1830s, though, the conditions were less welcoming, and there began to be a growing sort of dissension in town. But one of the things that happened in those early years was the growth of the caterers. In Philadelphia, it was said, if you're in catering, you're in the swim. If not, you're in the soup. This was because of a group of individuals who saw a niche in the market and filled it. In the North, and by this time there had been abolition, certainly, in most of the northern states, with no slaves to staff mid-size or bachelor households, a public butler, often a free person of color, was frequently engaged by those too small or too frugal to have their own servants in residence. Unlike a private butler employed by a single family, a public butler organized meals and waited on a number of different households. Robert Bogle created the role of caterer from that of public butler, although the term caterer did not come into wide usage until the mid-19th century. Bogle worked as such a butler and also as an undertaker. On occasion, he could be found presiding over a funeral during the day and a party that later that evening with equal aplomb. Bogle also functioned as a waiter and possibly purveyed meals and provided staff, if required, for household events. From these multiple occupations and with his diverse talents, Bogle became the first of Philadelphia's major black caterers. And soon, black caterers became the norm in the city. They formed a union that was, in the words of sociologist W.E.B. Du Bois, quote, as remarkable a trade guild as ever ruled a medieval city. The caterers took complete leadership of a bewildered group of Negroes and led them steadily to a degree of affluence, culture, and respect such as has probably never been surpassed in the history of the Negro in America, end quote. Bogle opened a catering establishment on 8th Street in Philadelphia, and according to Du Bois, he was, quote, the butler of the smart set, and his taste and eye and palate set the fashion for the day. Bogle became so famous that in 1829, Nicholas Biddle, I don't have to say any more than Biddle, a prominent white Philadelphian, penned a multi-stanza ode titled Biddle's Ode to Bogle, and I will leave you with that. Hail, mayest thou, Bogle, for thy reign extend o'er nature's wide domain, begins before our earliest breath, nor ceases with the hour of death. Scarce seems the blushing maiden wed, unless thy care the supper spread. Half christened only were the boy, whose heathen squalls our ear annoy, if service finished, cakes and wine were given by any hand but thine, and Christian burial e'er were scant, unless his aid the Bogle grant. There are more and more and more and more stories. I feel like that old TV show, There Are 6 Million Stories in the Naked City. The stories of African Americans and food are unending and still being discovered. It's the tip of the iceberg. The few names that I've called tonight and the others that are in the book are the tip of an extraordinary iceberg. And I'm going to leave you with these words. African Americans have long had a love affair with food, one perhaps unequaled in the history of the country. For centuries, we've brought the piquant tastes of Africa to the New World. With particular relish, we yam, grease, and grit, whether it's a bologna sandwich and a peanut patty tucked into the bib of overalls for a workman's snack, or a late-night supper of chitlins and champagne eaten off fine bone china. Some of us delight in a sip of white lightning from a mason jar at a juke joint, while others delicately lift little fingers and savor minted iced tea or a cool drink while fanning and watching the neighbors on the front porch. Good times or bad, food provides a time for communion and relaxation. It's so much a part of our lives that it seems at times as though a supreme being created us from a favorite recipe. There was a heaping cup full of cornmeal to signal our links with Native Americans, a rounded tablespoon of biscuit dough for Southern gentility, a mess of greens and a dozen okra pods for our African roots, and a good measure of molasses to recall the tribulations of slavery. A seasoning piece of fatback signals our lasting love for the almighty pig, and a smoked turkey wing foretells our healthier future. A handful of hot chilies give the mixture attitude and sass, while a healthy dose of bourbon mellows it out and a splash of corn liquor gives it a kick. There are regional additions, such as a bit of Benny. Benny is sesame in South Carolina. Benny is actually the Wolof word, Wolof, a language from Senegal, for sesame that has been maintained in South Carolina. A hint of praline from New Orleans, and a drop of at least 12 types of barbecue sauce. A fried porgy, a splash of homemade scuppernong wine, and a heaping portion of that secret ingredient called love fill the bowl to overflowing. When well mixed, it can be either baked, broiled, roasted, fried, sautéed, or barbecued, and the result has yielded us in all hues of the rainbow, from lightly toasted to deep, well done. We are now a new people. All the world comes together in us and on our plates, Africa, the Americas, Asia, and beyond. We eat hog maws or pickled meat, potatoes or plantains, sweet potatoes or yams, or both. Our greens are collards or callaloo or bok choy, and we serve them with everything from a ham hock to a smoked turkey wing to tofu. We savor fine aged rum agricole and still know how to knock back a good jelly jar of corn liquor or a jarra of cachaça. With a start like that, it's not surprising then that we have our own way with food. We've called it our way for centuries and incorporated our wondrous way with food and eating into our daily lives. We have rocked generations of babies to sleep while crooning shortening bread, laughed to the comedy of Pig Meat Martin and Butterbeans and Susie, danced the cake walk, and tapped our feet to the gut bucket music, that bucket of guts, those were the chitlins, of Jelly Roll Morton, and shimmied with wild abandon to that music in juke joints, gotten all hot and sweaty over salsa, or sat down with friends and just chewed the fat. We've had the blues over the kitchen man and longed to be loved like lilac wine and celebrated with a pig foot and a bottle of beer. In short, we've created our own culinary universe, one where an ample grandmother presides over a kitchen where the pungent aroma of greens mixes with the molasses perfume of pralines and the bubbling from a big iron gumbo pot punctuates her soft humming. This is the universe where Aunt Jemima takes off her kerchief and sits down at table, where Uncle Ben bows his head and blesses the food. The Louisiana coffee woman passes the plates, and Rastus, the cream of wheat man, tells tall tales over a taste of whiskey to the banana man. It's the warmth of the kitchen, tempered by the formality of the dining room, and the love of family that extends across generations and over bloodlines. With the improvisational genius that gave the world jazz and salsa, we have cooked our way into the hearts, minds, and stomachs of a country. And now I'd like to leave you with a few images. Just look. No commentary from me.
That's it. Thank you very much. So we've got a few minutes for questions. I have a feeling you have some. If you raise your hand, we'll get a mic to you. Please wait for the mic. And please phrase your question as a question. Who would like to start us off? The gentleman right in front here. To your right, sir.
I was curious. One of my early readings of someone who did a lot of research, as you have, it's brilliant, the work you've done.
Oh, thank you.
And then I would read the footnotes, and then I'd look for those books and found that these ancient books were republished because of this footnote. Has that happened with Odala?
Oh, Lauda Equiano is very much published, yes.
Is that right?
Yes, it's available and sort of standard reading in some African-American lit courses, yeah. Available in paperback.
Another question? Yeah, about six rows back in the middle there. Yeah, gentleman with his hand up.
And there's a woman behind him as well.
Hi.
Hi. Didn't we see each other at the SFA?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Well, in Philadelphia. My question has to do with some of the more modern portrayals. I know that in your book you go into the Food Channel and the Food Network. And this, I was just recently reading Psyche William Forson's book,
Building Houses Out of Chicken Legs.
And I'm wondering if you could sort of talk a bit about how the Food Network is in dialogue with other sources of media, TV, magazines to produce the, sort of the modern image of what, say, soul food is or what African American cooking is.
Never trust a grad student. Well, I mean, there are a whole lot. There's so much to be said about that. It's as you know, not a simple question. I'm not quite sure it was a question or an answer or a comment that I can give. The Food Network is the Food Network. It has determined what its audience is or what it thinks its audience is, which I may or may not agree with. It has therefore produced shows for them. Its audience is young, according to them, one would imagine, because there were very few older people on it. Not hideously well-educated, because it tends to speak to people who are not necessarily well-educated. A friend of mine, though, at some point said, you know, the great thing about the Food Network is there's never any bad news on the Food Network. So because there's never any bad news, and well, this was a friend whose wife was dying of cancer, and he said, we keep the Food Network turned on all the time because there's never any bad news. Made sense. I mean, there's never any bad news on the Food Network. There may never be any good news on the Food Network either. But I think that one of the things that you're probably trying to goad me into saying is I think that we tend to marginalize and not really look at the scope and the width and breadth of the food of African Americans. That's one of the things that I certainly tried to do in the book. It's not all the Neelys. It's not all barbecue and boo. It's not all Marcus Samuelson. It's not all soul food, which is a term that I'm not particularly fond of, simply because what it does is it marginalizes, balkanizes, and trivializes the food of African Americans, which has historically been so much wider, broader, and deeper than that. When I say soul food, you think of fried chicken, smothered pork chops, collard greens, potato salad, probably some wonderful, rich, sweet dessert. And I would arguably say maybe another 5 to 10 things. That's an awful small amount of food to have come out of people who have cooked for the rest of this country for its entire history. so that and it's also food that we now in our health kick trivialize and marginalize as being unhealthy. You know, you can't go eat soul food, it'll kill you. You know, all of those things. So there are 8 zillion different questions and multiple debates within your question. Those are my comments about a couple of them, but there was another question back there. I'm going to her.
Yeah, lady would have had her hand up. Could you please wait for the mic?
Yeah, the history of the concept of living high off the hog.
Oh.
My father, who was clearly not black, was
not
born in 1912. He wasn't.
But that's another point.
Born in 1912, and when our lives were good and we were having a great meal or we were in a great restaurant, he would talk to us. He would say, "We're living high off the hog." And I never understood what that meant as a kid. It's just, I don't know, sort of interesting.
Okay.
I'd like to know.
It's actually probably not in this copy of the book because it's something that I added a little bit later, but I will tell you. It goes back to plantation humor. And in plantation humor, there are a lot of trickster tales. John being the trickster, and John always finds a way to get over or get by or get around massa. And it's about hog killing time, and it's sort of a day probably not dissimilar to this day. And Massa goes down to the quarters and says to John, "Come on, John, it's hog killing time. You're gonna help me kill the hogs. I'm gonna give you all the feet, the ears, the tails, the head, and the guts. I'm gonna give you a bucket of guts, the chitlins, the hog maws." And John says, "Yes, sir." And he goes down. He helps the Massa kill the pig, and that happens over a period of years at hog killing time. Massa would go down to the quarters, find John, and say, "Come on, John, it's hog killing time. Come on down, and I'll give you a bucket of guts and the ears and the tail and the head and the feet." And then John got his own hog. And then he got another hog. He got another one. And that year at hog killing time, Massa came down to the quarters and said, "Come on, John, it's hog killing time. Come on down. I'm going to give you a bucket of guts and the head and the feet and the tails and the ears." And John said, "I don't rightly think so, Massa. I've got my own hog now, and I'm eating middling and bacon and pork chops and backbone. I'm eating ham. I'm eating high on the hog. High on the hog, not the feet, but the ham." So you want to eat higher on the hog.
Few more questions.
Hi.
Hi.
I run some cooking programs with high school students here in Philadelphia, and similar to what you were just talking about, a lot of times the high school students, you know, they'll refer to fast food, all kinds of things that may not even have much to do or may have to do with African American history, and they'll just be like, "Oh, that's black food," you know, and they'll kind of claim French fries. I mean, who knows what? They'll just kind of claim that, and at the same time they're really interested in kind of their history and their food ways, kind of in line with the footnotes. What might you recommend they check out if they're interested in reading a bit more about this?
Oh, shameless self-promotion. Start here. That would probably, I mean, the thing about this book is it is without footnotes. It's got a bibliography, and I'm trying to get a wiki up so that I can build a bibliography on the food of African Americans. But it's, I say in the introduction, I wrote it so that my grandmothers could read it. I had one grandmother who was virtually illiterate, and another grandmother who spoke in very biblical English. I think it's important for people to just be able to read. I think, you know, if they are really and in fact indeed interested. By the way, French fries may not be, but potato chips are. You know that. Okay, potato chips evolved from Saratoga chips. Saratoga chips evolved from game chips. Game chips were traditionally served with venison and game in England. They got to the United States. They were transformed by a black chef in Saratoga, New York, into Saratoga chips, which became potato chips. So they're not wrong. Okay, they're just a little off kilter. And that is the point. That's certainly one of the points that I try to make in the book, is that, and certainly the passage that I read about Bogle. I mean, African Americans have cooked for all layers of the society. One of the recipes that we have from James Hemings. James Hemings was Thomas Jefferson's slave cook. He was Sally Hemings' brother. Jefferson sent for James. James traveled to Paris. He arrived there in 1784, I think, right around the time of the French Revolution. He was apprenticed to Maître Combeau, who was the person who did the cooking and the catering for Jefferson's household. Jefferson was the, the ambassadeur plénipotentiaire. So he was the plenipotentiary ambassador to the court of Louis XVI. Hemings, no doubt, was astonished to realize that when Jefferson was in Paris, he was pretty much regarded as what the French would call a plouc, somebody who was a rustic. He was important over here, but up against French royalty, he was like, yeah, well, badly dressed, didn't particularly eat well because he ate more like an English lord than like a French noble, or an English country squire than like a French noble. And so Hemings was sent to apprentice at a variety of different kitchens around Paris, including the kitchen of the Prince de Condé, the princes of Condé. The Condé family are princes of the blood, meaning that they have royal blood. They're the only higher place that Hemings could have cooked would have been at the palace itself. So in the course of all of this, he obviously learns how to cook in a variety of different ways. He learns how to use copper utensils as opposed to the cast iron that had been more the norm here. He learns how to use a potager, a stew hole stove, as opposed to the hearth cooking that would have been the norm. And he learns all of these things and brings them back when he comes and begs Jefferson to be manumitted. He is. Jefferson does manumit him, with the proviso that he teach someone else all that he has learned. He teaches a brother, and so the Hemings family continues to have its rule over the Jeffersonian kitchens. But I say all of that large professorial parentheses to simply say the trivializing into soul food of the food of African Americans denies these people their rightful place at the table. And they were there.
And I think that's where we'll have to end the evening. Please join me in thanking Jessica Harris. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.